Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. When the normal fight or flight response to stress becomes more of a chronic issue and particularly affects our day-to-day life, we have post-traumatic stress disorder. To help us learn more about this problem, we have with us today in the studio Anchorage psychiatrist Dr. Robert Wald and licensed clinical social worker Prentice Pemberton. Both are from Bridges Counseling Connection here in Anchorage. You can reach us with questions or comments if you're here in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And, of course, you can email us during the next hour as well at line1@alaskapublic.org. And you need to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Wald, welcome to Line 1, and Prentice, same to you.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. Dr. Wald is trying to tell us he's got 50 years of psychiatric experience, so he's got a lot of experience and has been a past president of the Alaska Psychiatric Association and has been in Anchorage since the 90s.
That's right, 1993.
And Prentice Pemberton got his master's of social work at the University of Alaska Anchorage and has been practicing around here since then?
95, I came up here. I've been in private practice for the last five to six years now.
All right. And the information I have says you particularly like talking about anxiety, depression, and mood disorders.
That's primarily what I do is mood disorders, anxiety, depression, adolescent issues.
All right. Before we get started, let's talk a little bit about the Bridges Counseling Connection. What goes on there? Who's there? What are you interested in trying to do?
Well, Bridges was started by myself and Lori Hickman and Carlin Larson about, I guess it was the fall of 2008. We were all working at another institution and in town and decided we wanted to do something that was smaller, a little higher quality, we thought, and not just running people through the mill and trying to get billable hours. So it's now evolved into I think we have five clinicians, two psychiatrists now, so it's grown and it's been very rewarding.
One of the things that that maybe everybody doesn't understand and is sometimes difficult for practitioners trying to get, particularly Medicaid patients, into some kinds of therapy is that if there's not a psychiatrist on staff, if you're not a psychiatrist, then you really can't bill for Medicaid care of psychological services. Is that true?
That's one of the limitations, right. Yes, to the Medicaid system is that it is required to have a licensed psychiatrist on site, actually, mm-hmm. For a certain percentage of the time in order for us to be able to bill Medicaid.
Okay. Just kind of thought I'd throw that out there. It's just it is, you know, as people who listen to this program know, I really think we all underappreciate the importance of the psychosocial issues in medical care, and particularly, and that there's a huge need for those kinds of services to be available. So things that kind of put a damper on our ability, particularly with Medicaid patients, are sometimes pretty frustrating for us to get the care we're looking for. But that's more of a personal opinion maybe than any other kind of statement, but I think it's worth noting again. So we're here talking about, or we said we were going to talk about post-traumatic stress, but before we go there, I think of, or my understanding is, post-traumatic stress is a subcategory of anxiety disorders. So somebody tell me if I'm right, and then let's talk about what anxiety is and then what the anxiety disorders are.
Well, yes, anxiety disorders are post-traumatic stress disorder is a piece of that. And anxiety disorders, I kind of think of an anxiety disorder when somebody has an anxiety attack, I call it anticipated suffering. It's that something bad is going to happen, and without, whether it's real or imagined. And it's an interesting phenomenon, and everybody experiences. I mean, I get a little anxiety here before we got started. My mm-hmm. stomach kind of flutters, and so everybody experiences anxiety. Anxiety is a naturally occurring thing. Without anxiety, we'd all be dead, I think. You know, mm-hmm. we would get eaten.
Mm-hmm. Another way of saying it is that anxiety is a fear of the unknown, mm-hmm. of an uncertainty. Mm-hmm. When we have a certainty and we know what we're afraid of, we can identify it, and we call it a fear.
Mm-hmm. I've heard it said, and I'm not sure where, that most of the anxiety is about things that are thought might happen in the future. We don't have much anxiety about the past, necessarily.
Sometimes what has happened to us in the past is anticipated to occur in the future.
Right.
Or
right.
some deviant example of it, or modified example of it. Mm-hmm. So it becomes an unknown, mm-hmm. even though on examination, and that's part of what we do in therapy, is to examine what that anxiety is and come to understand that it may be derived from something that has happened. Mm-hmm. Or feared in the past.
And what has happened in the past that may have caused some stress or anxiety does not necessarily mean the same thing would happen in the future. Is that, that's part of the cognitive behavioral approach?
Yeah, that's the point, yes. Yeah.
What other disorders, I'm thinking of performance anxiety. Are there other subcategories of this anxiety group?
Well, I'd want to be good enough to please my daddy. Mm-hmm. Who's been gone for 100 years, but we have the idea that performance is to be measured in some terms that are usually not well-defined. Mm-hmm. When in the case, and they are well-defined, then they are more easily overcome mm-hmm. because we can measure.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes anxiety just takes on an energy of its own and we become fearful of the fear, meaning right. that we anticipate the mm-hmm. suffering coming, and so it increases and has a snowball effect and gets bigger and bigger until it's out of control and we can't stop it.
Yeah. And I've made the diagnosis once myself as not a psychologist or a psychiatrist of generalized anxiety disorder in a patient or two that just seemed to have overwhelming, unreasonable concerns about things that were going to happen. I can't remember, a teenage girl who always had something in her purse in case there was a car accident that she was in. I mean, just constantly thinking about what's the worst possible thing that could possibly happen to me.
Anxiety is, like I said, it's natural. It's a necessary thing that human beings and animals have. Mm-hmm. But anxiety disorder, when it goes into the disease process, it becomes not adaptive and it's no longer a rational fear. Mm-hmm. A rational anxiety is not a disorder, but an irrational one is an anxiety
disorder. Is another way to say it is kind of the way I introduced it, when it begins to affect your day-to-day life, is that, I mean, that's something I think about as psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers use as an example of when something may need to be addressed, is when it's beginning to affect us. Is that true?
When it
begins to affect our day-to-day life.
Yes, when it becomes a disabling event, yeah. a disabling state. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the important thing we want to hear today is that anxiety is normal. That's not a problem. It's when it begins to really
become uncomfortable mm-hmm. or affect our performance, either with other people or with our sleep or with our appetite mm-hmm. or with our work. Yes.
Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guests today are Dr. Robert Wald, a psychiatrist here in Anchorage, and Prentice Pemberton, a licensed clinical social worker with Bridges Counseling Connection, both of them. We're talking about anxiety, but particularly we're going to be talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. If you have questions, comments, experiences you'd like to share, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. During the next hour, we'll also be available by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Okay, so let's now focus in on one of these anxiety disorders that we've hear so much spoken about, is called post-traumatic stress disorder. I guess I'm thinking that the public may have heard of this disorder related to military men that are coming back from Vietnam, Iran, and Iraq, and Afghanistan more, but it's also shows up in the newspaper in individuals with more non-military-like situations. So try to put some frame of reference on this disorder.
I think the traditional understanding of PTSD is the military returning home, a significant car crash, a violent crime where you are, where your life, your physical safety is threatened. And that's the classic term. I mean, PTSD only came into being in the early 80s as a recognized disorder, and has since evolved. I think as we learn more and more about it, it's starting to spill over into more. We understand that exposed, prolonged, what we call smaller T's, instead of a big trauma, it's a little trauma, such as neglect, kids who don't get all their needs met, that sort of stuff, can have significant impacts as well. So it's not just the big traumas that we associate it with.
So like many things in medicine, the definition or the appreciation of the disorder is spreading, is
right.
widening.
It diffuses.
Diffusing.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And not in a bad sense, but in a sense that we have a better understanding of it once this is defined and we begin to recognize it where we didn't recognize it before.
That's right. The edges of it spread out, and we understand now other conditions that we have been treating and calling by a variety of different names, really subsumed under the notion of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay. It's just that's a very common problem, and it does cause difficulty sometimes in the public because autism, for example. The question is, are we having more autism? Well, maybe not. But for one thing's for sure is the definition and our appreciation of what we call autism has certainly enlarged quite a bit. And what we used to call mental retardation or some other disorders is now seems pretty clearly to fit better in that diagnostic category.
That's certainly true.
It seems to be that we're moving into, you mentioned autism, it's now autistic, it's spectrum disorder, and FASD,
right.
Fetal alcohol syndrome, has also gone to a spectrum.
Good point.
It wouldn't surprise me one bit if when the next DSM came out, there was some sort of category of post-traumatic stress spectrum disorder.
Okay. Well, we have a caller. Let's go ahead and talk to Don. Don, you're on line one.
All right. Can you hear me?
You betcha.
Great. Yeah, you guys are talking about post-traumatic stress. I was traveling around Europe back in the 90s, and I didn't heed the cautions about going into the former Yugoslavia, the Balkans. And I ended up in the area of Croatia in the Knin region, and the Serbs had just made a major offensive, and they were pulling out of this village. But the stress that had occurred, I had totally repressed those memories for about 10 or 15 years, and I was telling a story to a friend of mine, and he was a NAM vet, and I started having these vivid images coming back to me, like I guess what you'd call flashbacks. My heart rate went up. I got really panicky, and he kept saying to me, and then what? And then what happened? And so all this these repressed memories about this battle, this war that I had been in, as a spectator, came back to me, came up to the surface, and I totally forgotten about all that stuff, and he kind of helped me to realize I had post-traumatic stress. And I told him, I said, yeah, but I'm a civilian. I was non-military. I wasn't prepared for any of that stuff. And he said, you know, there's nothing that prepares you for that. And he said, you don't have to be in the military to have post-traumatic stress.
My suggestion to you would be to get a new travel agent.
I'm the adventure seeker. You know, I threw those guidebooks to the wind and said, I'm going to go find it myself. And it led me to some great adventures and some very scary ones.
Congratulations. You certainly did successfully handle the stress at the time it occurred. And your colleague or whoever it was, I was quite correct, and you are correct in identifying it as post-traumatic stress disorder. And we should really thank you for bringing it to our attention.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, can you hang on just a second, Don?
Sure.
Yeah, one of my next questions is what kind of symptoms you had, and if Dr. Walden Prentice don't tell me not to ask, I'm going to ask you what kind of what kind of symptoms? You mentioned some of the things about your heart rate going up and so forth. I'd just be curious if you wouldn't mind sharing maybe a little bit more detail.
Well, I had studied martial arts for many years, and I used to be a street fighter, and so there's this thing that happens with someone who's programmed their bodies and the muscle memory, and so you know we call it flight or fight, and in that arena I fled. There wasn't anything else I could do, but I fled mentally because I couldn't leave physically, but mentally I checked out. And even to this day, I get very anxious in certain situations, you know, like I don't like to fight anymore, so I try to avoid those places or anything that could trigger a defense mode. And that's simply because I'll black out, and techniques will flow right through the body, and I won't even be conscious of any of it.
So you're afraid you're going to act out some of your fight or flight without conscious control of it.
That's exactly what happens. Mm. When you see someone who's like the military, the special forces guys, when they go through those techniques, they don't think, it just happens because they've rehearsed this move over and over 1,000 times. And so like in my case, I just have this, the fear for me is that I'm going to black out, and I haven't done it in a long, long time, but the anxiety is there. Sometimes with simple things like communicating with other people and perhaps saying something that might be uncomfortable but true, and you know, or establishing boundaries with other individuals, sometimes those are great challenges for me. And it's not that I'm a bad person or a passive aggressive or anything like that. It's just it's that fight or flight is in there somewhere. You know, like I feel the anxiety of either the rejection or the conflict or what have you, and I try to avoid those things as much as possible, but I don't know that that's entirely healthy either. You know?
Hey, Don, this is Prentice. I wanted to point out one thing. You make a great point about the delay that you experience from the traumatic experience and then the onset of your symptoms. That is often a case where there is a big delay in time because your body, what happened to you, it sounds like, is that you went into defense mode, where you just survival mode, you just have to get through whatever it was you got to get through, and then at a later time when things are safe and a trigger happened, it flooded you with all those memories. So that's a really good point that you bring up. The question
it's kind of embarrassing, but I'll tell you, right after that battle in the Knin, I'd seen a tank that was burning, and there was a man who was carbonized, who was trying to escape the tank, and in the streets, you know, where you'd see blood puddles, there were mud puddles. And I just went, this is not happening. This is not real. This is not happening. I completely shut down. And then some time had elapsed, but I had been wandering around Croatia making bouquets of dried weeds. And it just seemed like they were the most beautiful thing I had ever beheld, and it was important to me to do that. It sounds nuts, but the Croatian cops, at one point, somebody, you know, they saw I must have, something was going on with me, because they were like, who are you? And I had to stop and think about that question, because it hadn't occurred to me that that was anything of any importance, but those bouquets of weeds were, you know? That's probably really bizarre, but
It's not bizarre. It's extremely interesting. It feels to me that it's some artistic or creative element within yourself handled the stressful, almost overwhelming experience of seeing all that death and dishonor of bodies and so forth, and you were figuratively making memorials. You were dressing funerals. You were paying attention to natural beauty.
I never thought about it like that. That's really profound. And the other thing was, I stayed in the region for many months, and I could have left at any time, but I stayed in the region almost sympathetic to what was going on there or something.
Well, Don, thanks very much for sharing that experience with us.
Thank you so much, guys.
You guys, good luck.
Bye.
Yep. Jim, you're on line one.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've got a question. My granddaughter, by way of saving her brother's life, was run over by a farm tractor. It's been, I don't know, 24, 25 years ago. And I always felt that she had a mental problem after that, and that she couldn't handle things, that no kind of stress. And if she was told no, it was just something that she just couldn't handle the word no. She had to have this or that or whatever it was. And I've always said that she's had some problem, and I didn't know how to deal with that. And later in life, she got married, and her husband and her decided to have a kid. And after 7 years of marriage and decided, well, let's have a child, it was 3 weeks after the child was born, he says, I'm not coming home, I want a divorce. I wound up that there was another woman. And she was devastated, and I think still to this day has that problem. And it's been like 5 years. And I think that it's post-traumatic stress disorder. Is there anywhere a civilian can get help with that? Because she doesn't seem to be able to hold a job. She's always in debt, always has problems. She's not on drugs or anything. She doesn't take drugs or drink, any more than occasional drink. But she just doesn't seem to make good decisions. So is there any way to somebody who doesn't have any money can take care of that?
Well, one of the good things you mentioned is there's no drugs and alcohol on board. That just complicates things and makes it very, very difficult. But how old was she at the time when she run over?
She was 8 or 9 years old. May have been 7, but I think it was 8 or 9 at the time. And she ran over the tractor. And, of course, there was a settlement and all that. But that still didn't help the matters now that she's roughly 30 and now she got her own bunch of problems in life, and it just seems like she can't get started again from childhood. You know, that's where she ended. She's still 9 years old in her decision making and ideas and all. That's my point of view.
It certainly sounds like it could be related to an event if there were noticeable changes after that event. And those feelings and emotions never got resolved fully. So certainly to have her evaluated by somebody who specializes in PTSD, I don't know if she's ever done that before, but that would be the place I would start if she has a willingness to do that.
No, not had any kind of evaluation whatsoever.
All right. She would have to be willing to go and do that, and then that's the first step, is to get a thorough evaluation to see what exactly is going on, but it certainly sounds like it could be.
As far as the financial problems that he's mentioned his daughter has, there's the Anchorage Mental Health Center, which should be able to see her regardless of financial issues. Is that true?
Or they have
are there other?
They have arrangements that can be made, and they work. It's the Anchorage Neighborhood Community Health Mental Health Center.
She's not in this state, so that's the problem I'm having. There's no way that I can get there. Everybody, this economy is really taking its toll on everyone.
Yep.
Does she have any family members in the area where she is?
I'd have to say no.
Or close friends who could assist her in sort of locating and identifying the local resources that can evaluate her? Because most communities do have some sort of community mental health center that she can go to for a sliding scale fee or a reduced fee. But it sounds like she would need some support.
I'm the one who's going to have to look into that. That's what I'm just trying to get a feeling of that. Is there an organization that I can call that would have an idea of the state she's in, what is there and what is not there?
Yeah, I don't, I guess... I'm trying to think how you might do it. if you could, whatever community she's in, you might go on the internet and put in that community's name and then put mental health center or something and see if something comes up that way. Otherwise, the local medical association of the municipality, city, or state should be able to tell you by telephone or email about options like that.
Thank you very much. I'll try that.
Yep. Well, good luck, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, let's take another phone call. Carolyn, you're on line one.
This is Caroline. I wanted to find out about trauma in a child. Is it more difficult if it's been a long-term anxiety than it is if it's an immediate or short-term trauma? And one of the things that I heard some time ago was that if there are three traumas during a child's time, I'd say, you know, under six, under 10, somewhere in there, that their brain begins to develop these traumas. That it becomes, say, like a heightened incident over what it actually was, that the child's brain begins to develop these scenarios.
Do you mean that in a physical sense, like there's a remodeling of the brain or these into a more permanent situation? Is that what you're getting at?
I'm not sure how it works,
okay.
But I heard that it did happen.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Wald. It is certainly true that the brain continues developing in the early years of life. The questions you're asking have to do with whether the traumas the child has experienced are similar to one another, whether the same sort of thing, whether or not there was any relief for the traumas as they occurred or how they were handled. It's a complicated issue as you present it, but it certainly sounds as if you're concerned enough to seek help for this child, or at least inquire about help, to see whether or not these things have had an effect on the child that will carry forward into his adult life.
Well, the thing the person mentioned to me was that it was like living in a landmine area where you never knew what was going to happen.
Right.
You know, where you put your foot, whether it was going to be safe or whether it was going to blow up.
Yeah. It makes me think immediately about a family situation where there might be an alcoholic or a drug abuser, somebody that's really maybe affecting the child, and so that the children and everybody in that household don't know how to act, kind of thing. Now, I may be overthinking this, but that's the kind of thought that you're giving me. And is that correct?
Well, the thing that I was told is there was no. There was just rage. There was just an emotional, uh-huh.
Right.
Rage, and there was no substance abuse. But the,
okay.
I also heard that one type of abuse morphs into another if the drug is taken away. That it doesn't really change the dry drunk. Somebody described the person as being a dry drunk. But anyway, that was the thing. And then the other quick question had to do with whether or not the long term aspects of this. Of this person's childhood would have caused longer-term need for therapy over if something had happened like in a limited, like a rape or something of that nature.
Right.
Is there any kind of study on that?
So what I'm hearing is a couple of questions here. One is, I think I'm going to go ahead and say, I don't think it takes three episodes in a child to cause harm. One episode could be enough. And then the next question is, do multiple episodes over time make it more of a difficult thing to treat? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yes,
Okay.
It seems to me that there are at least two possibilities. The repetition of the difficulty might become accustomed by the child and being able to handle it. And usually the effect is that the way the child would handle this repetition would be to distort the reality he experiences himself. So by the time he's grown up, he really has a complex issue that needs to be looked at. Otherwise, it will pervert his intention to develop a normal and productive life.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a big help. And the comment that was made was that as adults, we repeat what we knew as children unless there's intervention. It was called seeking the steady state, so that, you know, we replicate the environment or maintain the stress or something of that nature. And that seemed to be, you know, kind of a scary thing that we're going to do as adults or create as adults what we knew as children.
Well, one of the things that one of my favorite quotes was that, you know, we are who our parents raised us to be. And, you know, there is some truth in that parenting and exposure, long-term exposure in childhood can create all sorts of emotional problems in adulthood. But that does not mean that it can't be changed and it can't be altered through intervention and seeking out help. I believe the earlier the better. But I have worked with many adults in my practice who have been exposed to long-term trauma and have made significant changes in a relatively short period of time.
Well, that's very encouraging, and thank you for this program.
Okay, Carolyn. Good luck. Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and any emails. My guests today are Dr. Robert Wald and clinical social worker Prentice Pemberton. We're talking about post-traumatic stress. This is Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We've been discussing normal stress and anxiety and abnormal stress and anxiety, and to help us understand these problems, with me today is Anchorage psychiatrist Dr. Robert Wald and licensed clinical social worker Prentice Pemberton. Both are from Bridges Counseling Connection here in Anchorage. We've had a couple of callers willing to express some of their previous experiences with post-traumatic stress. We've talked a little bit about some treatment kinds of options and general advice. If you've got questions or comments along these lines, you can email us over the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our email or our phone number is 550-8433. And if you're outside of Anchorage or you need a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, we'll get you to us. And remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, that's a rebroadcast of the recorded program, so we won't be able to answer questions. Also, if you go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Line 1 link, you can get some information about links that we would suggest, and in particular, a good one would be the National Institute of Mental Health website on post-traumatic stress. There's some video information as well as some written information for you, and a link to the Bridges Counseling Connection as well. So we've heard some certainly stressful reports from a couple of individuals already today, but you had mentioned, Prentice, at the beginning that it doesn't have to be such a dramatic stress or event that can trigger this kind of problems. Could you expand on that, at least within reference to what we've heard so far in this program?
Well, if I understand what you're asking correctly, it's talking about maybe neglect in children,
right,
or yes, the sort of more subtle,
yeah,
the subtle stuff. Yeah, for sure. I think people and children in particular understand things in their world differently than adults do. And for kids, you know, things like neglect and just not being paid attention to or called names or you're stupid, you know, things like, which my daughter says is a bad word every time, mm-hmm, it comes out of anybody's mouth. those things can have a devastating effect on self-esteem, how people, the self-confidence, how they feel about themselves, and how they view the world, as the caller mentioned earlier, as a safe place. And for kids to not view the world as a safe place can be devastating and have lasting effects into teenage life, where they may be re-traumatized again by bullying, and which is a huge problem in,
right.
in
the
school
districts. Right. I was
just
thinking about bullying.
Absolutely.
Is an issue where...
Many of my clients are the mm-hmm. teenagers are mm-hmm. are often complaining about bullying of varying degrees, mm-hmm. From the minor kind of stuff to just mm-hmm. overt, mm-hmm. Really cruel stuff.
Right. Oh. Yeah, I had a young boy not too long ago who's very bright, very smart, very small, and has taken a lot of grief about his size to the point that it's really, really affected him significantly. And it's very, very difficult to see that kind of thing happen. So that also can be a source of post-traumatic stress as we understand it today.
Yes, I agree with that. Any deviation from the norm that calls attention to the self can elicit criticism or objection or bullying or teasing. It could just as well be to a tall, slender boy among a group of mm-hmm. ordinary mm-hmm. kids mm-hmm. who'd be called stretch mm-hmm. or teased by being called shorty.
What happens in our brain when things like that happen? When you're saying that, I'm thinking, my mind goes back to a situation when I was a teenager and I walked into a room and some guy made some unbelievably mean comment about the way my hair was parted. Doesn't bother me to this day, but I remember that like it was, you know, a gunshot going off in the room. What what is happening in our brain when that goes on?
Wouldn't that be an interesting thing to know?
Yeah,
but
I
it
mean,
certainly
so,
is a locked-in piece of memory.
Yeah, I've heard the term locked, or brilliant memory that happened.
We once in a while encounter an experience that is so evocative of memory that it's not just memory like you just did yourself, but a total recall of the event, the recall, the surroundings, the smell of it, the look of it, the temperature of the air around you at the time it happened.
Right.
Absolute total recall.
Right. Speaking of memory, we're getting a little off the subject, but it's what's going on in neurosciences now is just amazing. And the cognitive sciences is a kind of an offshoot of neurosciences. And we now know that people's memories are not very reliable. So when this gentleman was telling me about the place in the Balkans where he had the problem, my first thought was, is he recalling the situation correctly? I believe he was. That's where my mind went. Because we now know that our mind begins to just tell the story as if we want it to be over time, as I understand what we're seeing about memory now.
Well, sometimes a story oft repeated evokes responses from the audience that feed that part of our recall
right.
that gets rewarded.
Right.
So if
okay.
I tell you something that
right.
happened to me and you
right.
cry about it,
right.
then that enforces that aspect of the memory in my mind. So the next time I talk about it, I'll focus on that.
Yeah. I heard a
detail.
Podcast recently that one of the women who watched was at Daily Plaza when Kennedy was shot. Their first interview said she didn't see anything, and now she and people don't believe that she's making this up. But now she's told the story so many times that you listen to her interview now compared to where it was the first time she was interviewed. They're not even close.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I mean, hard to argue that in front of a judge, though.
All right. Well, let's talk about treatment. Let's do something else. One of my big interests here would be prevention. It's always better if we can. And I interviewed somebody probably 2 years ago who was a experimental or research psychologist at Columbia. And what they were doing with mice was interesting. They were trying to do something about anxiety, and they found that there's very well documented, there's a consolidation phase of memory. So when something happens, if you can do something before that memory is consolidated, that they could teach mice that they didn't have to be afraid of something that used to shock them all the time. So that you know, whether that's really anxiety or what's going on. So the issue is, are there things we can do to soldiers, who are going into battle? Are there things we can do with people who have had a a very significant anxiety-producing moment fairly quickly, I'm guessing, to try to keep this from being an issue the rest of their lives.
Well, it seems to me the fact that everybody coming back from combat doesn't go through
right.
the severity that we're talking about
right.
indicates that there's been some training, whether it was their army training, probably their army training that prepared them for the trauma that they would experience. Mm-hmm. They come back and are able to integrate back into their lives and the society without all these special problems that we're talking about today. Indicates that there are means of preventing recurrence of the trauma to the degree that it inhibits or reclaims their life in such a way that they can't function.
But another explanation would be that there are some kind of mental mechanisms that may be stronger in certain individuals, maybe before life experiences or genetic, that may let them be less predisposed.
Prentice and I were talking earlier today about that, and we think that the more stable, the more healthful, the less traumatic the childhood was of the mm-hmm. individual mm-hmm. adult, mm-hmm. the less likely they develop severe post-traumatic stress disorder mm-hmm. from the experience later in life. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I believe that if a child is raised in a home where they learn that the world is a safe place and that it's not about suffering, they're more likely to view an event, traumatic event or a traumatic experience, as something out of the norm, and that they shouldn't anticipate that that will continue to happen. If they're exposed to lots of significant traumas over their lifetime, it makes sense that it's an expectation. We go back to anxiety and anticipated mm-hmm. suffering. It's an expectation that bad things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that can lead, I would think, to predisposition.
Getting back to what's going on in the brain along this same line, I have used the example that what we now know is that, for example, when you learn to ride a bike, the more you practice, the more certain pathways are reinforced. In fact, we know that myelin, which makes nerve conduction speed up, increases in certain areas of the brain when somebody learns to play a violin or a clarinet or ride a bike. And what's unique about the brain is that you can't unlearn it. There's nobody out there that knows how to unlearn how to ride a bike on purpose. So is it true, is this, to take what you're saying, is if you see these constant stresses, unsafety, that you set up neural circuits in your brain that are more likely to recur? And is that the same thing that may happen with performance anxiety, for example? Is every time you go before and get ready to sing, you vomit or get so excited? Is that, you think it's physically there's a track that's going on in these situations?
There is a physiological response to anxiety. It's a body response. And right. I think memories are stored in the body because we all have experiences where we're triggered and we get our stomach hurts or, you know, when you almost hit the moose and then after the thing's over, you're shaking and you feel sick. So, yeah, the body stores memories physiologically, if that answers what you're saying.
I'm looking more in the brain.
I don't think we know enough about it.
Okay, all right.
I think it's an exciting area of study.
Right.
And perhaps our next generation.
We do know that medications can be effective, however, which suggests there is a biochemical basis to some of this. Is that fair to say?
Yes, there is a biochemical basis.
Yeah.
That is altered by the medications. What we don't know is the extent and the areas of the brain that are specifically altered or what the meaning of the alteration is. We just know that certain chemicals have certain effects.
Mm-hmm. I did see a study, and I would have to find it, but where complex long-term trauma in a child developmentally changes the structure of the brain that it looks different on brain imaging.
Right. And the other thing we got to remember is that we're all coming through this childhood and everything with a lot different genetics, a lot different experiences, a lot different molding, and different intelligence. There's a lot of factors, and this is very, very difficult kinds of stuff to work out. But let's talk some more about therapy. What are the therapies that we try? What are the therapies we know that work? What's the gold standard? What do we need to say about this?
Well, we can start out with I would call the older, more established therapies, which are psychotherapy based principally on the ideas of Freud, but derivative of them. They've wandered far afield from them, is to reduce the stress of the current experience and then to search out what the basis of the stress was or is, to go through the history of the individual's background and go as far back as possible to find what may have been an upsetting experience or a traumatic experience, and then help the person recognize that that experience no longer exists or is experienced in such a different form that new strategies can be used to relieve it, and then to test it out with additional life experience that demonstrates to the individual that they are masters of their fate, that they can proceed without the fear and caution that they may have restricted themselves in the past. That's a long-term, long answer to a long experience mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. traditionally has been a long experience. I now turn it over to Prentice mm-hmm. with his shorter answer.
less philosophical, maybe. Huh?
Yeah, that was deep. You know, I think cognitive behavioral therapy right. certainly is one that is looked at as a well-accepted method for treating. EMDR therapy is another one that has become quite accepted in the last 20 to 22 years. It came around. It's relatively new. So those, you know, exposure therapy is another one where you're just sort of exposing that person over and over to a stimuli, some sort of trigger or event, and having them realize that it's not still occurring and that they're okay and they're safe. And you do this with people. You hear about the classic example is the fear of flying.
Yep.
You know, you walk them to the right. airport and you gradually increase the pressure as they realize that they're okay.
So you show them that they're what they think is going to happen doesn't happen.
Correct.
Basically.
Yeah.
What does cognitive behavioral therapy mean?
It is thinking and behavior. Cognitive is thinking mm-hmm. and behavior obviously is mm-hmm. behavior. So mm-hmm. that one impacts the other. That by changing the way we think about things, we can change our behavior and our physiological responses. So that if I believe, you know, the power of positive thinking sort of, if I believe that something is going to occur and I continue to play out in my head that bad things are going to happen, they probably will. And that if I can shift the structure of my thinking, that my behavior can also then be improved.
And then it's reinforced with practice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of thinking through the reality of the situation, having people really think through the reasonableness of their concerns. And maybe there's more to cognitive behavioral therapy than I'm thinking, although it's extremely important and well-established and useful activity. I keep trying to grapple with what it all means.
Well, I think to use a model,
mm-hmm.
Prentice, please correct me if you need to. A person is afraid of elevators.
Mm-hmm.
They, for some reason or another, have a fear of going up or down an elevator.
Mm-hmm.
The behavioral therapist examines that with the person
mm-hmm.
and, in fact, suggests or accompanies that individual to an elevator
mm-hmm.
and asks them to imagine what's going to happen. And then they proceed to have the experiment of going in the elevator and seeing that it doesn't happen
mm-hmm.
and pointing out the fear that the person feels, honoring it, not disregarding mm-hmm.
it right.
or disrespecting it. And gradually the person becomes accommodated to the fact that they can go up and down the elevator and their pants don't get wet
mm-hmm.
and the elevator doesn't fall.
Is it also pointing out that you're more likely to have a serious problem driving to the elevator than it is riding the elevator? Is that
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of exposure therapy as well. I mean, all yeah. these things kind of overlap.
Right,
But cognitive behavioral therapy, I think of like having somebody, I have my clients a lot of times write appreciations, like positive thoughts from throughout the day.
Right.
And that positive thinking, and then when they wake up the morning, I say, talk about how your day is going to be in a positive way. I'm going to be a better mother. I'm going to be a better friend. And then so you set that stuff up in your brain, and then the theory is that your behavior will follow.
Mm-hmm.
It's cognitive behavioral therapy is a very here and now today sort right. of approach.
It's like retraining how your inner thinking or inner speech is. So
you wake up in the morning, you open your eyes, and you say, "Ah,
yeah.
like this day's going to be horrible." then your day's likely to be horrible. If you wake up and say, "All right, it's only Monday," right? Like the commercial says, "It's only Monday."
Yeah.
It's probably going to be a decent day. So that's
it's relearning how to ride the bike a little bit differently, so to speak.
Yeah, don't crash.
And it takes practice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's retraining the making new connections in the brain is.
And I agree with Prentice, and I emphasize one point that I also ask my patients to write down what their feelings are. Not necessarily what their aspirations are, but what their feelings are. And once your fears and thoughts and worries are written down and you can review them past the point where you're feeling that, you can recognize that they are transient, that they're not permanent, and that's a big step forward.
Got an email just to jump off the subject of treatment just briefly. I didn't notice when I was first reading this, but this is George Carlin's comment. He said after World War II, it was called shell shock. After World War I, it was shell shock. Then it was World War II battle fatigue. After Vietnam, I can't remember. After Gulf War, it was post-traumatic stress. Like Carlin, I think shell shock is more descriptive of this disorder, whether one has been to war or not, sent in by a listener.
Yeah, Dr. Wald and I were talking about the evolution of PTSD as a diagnosis
right.
and made those very same points. Right. It's always been around.
Right.
And these things that we're labeling and changing and, relabeling and rechanging, they're all just human beings having a difficult time getting through life sometimes based on exposure to difficult events. And, as a therapist, I really try to stay away from labels and classifying people because it just puts people in boxes and, I guess we have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting comment. Also in medicine, we're getting more and more to where we're trying to just describe where your problem is and rather to call you certain things, although the whole economy and how we reimburse and how we put people in school is all based on certain things. It makes it more difficult. And I find that patients sometimes want that. They don't want to hear a descriptive term of, you got an arthritis. I want to know what kind of arthritis. Anyway.
What do I have and what pill can I take to fix it?
What's wrong with pills for this? I tell patients that pills may help. I'm thinking about depression, maybe anxiety. They may work faster. They may work well, but they're not the long-term answer in the sense that they don't really change anything that's happened to us, and that the long-term answers are the cognitive behavioral therapy, the psychotherapy thing. Is that?
I think that's correct.
I think
it's a fair analogy. The pills will relieve the pain, but they won't fix the fracture, or the other pill will relieve the pain or the sweating, but it won't treat the infection. Mm-hmm. But going back to a statement you made a moment before, the effort to generalize and simplify in medicine in general, we're thinking in terms of inflammation as a cause of lots of different diseases, of different systems and different organs. What a new idea.
From about 1800. Anyway, okay, that's an inside one, I guess. So another comment about the medications, gosh darn it, I'm going to forget what I was about to say here. They don't change anything. Oh, I read a study recently that suggested that maybe for depression, maybe for anxiety, I don't remember the thing, that the evidence is accumulated, that there's some evidence that the reason those medications may also be useful is they then allow cognitive behavioral therapy to proceed better than it otherwise would because it is making some changes in the brain physically, or at least with these biochemically, that it makes people allow them to now be able to listen to things. I mean, when you're, and process the therapy that's going on.
I have a lot of clients that don't want to take medications.
Right.
They're very opposed to them,
right.
But they're having panic attacks and they can't get out of bed and they say, I don't want to depend on a pill. And, you know, I've never been a huge, throw a pill at it kind of guy, but I describe it to them as kind of, you have to lift the fog because if you can't see anything,
all right.
Then it's hard to, just like you said, it's hard to start to make those changes. So yes, if you can lift that acute, intense depression or anxiety so that people are freed up to begin working on those things is an excellent point.
We have about 2 minutes left in the program. This has been, for me, a very, very interesting, much more free-flow kind of thing that I like to do, and I hopefully we have listeners feeling the same way. Are there final comments? We really didn't talk about EMDR very much, which is eye movement desensitization and reprogramming. I don't know if we want to go there too much now. Some of this, go ahead.
I'll have a quick, it's reprocessing.
Or reprocessing.
Yeah, not reprogramming.
Yeah, I said reprogramming. I wrote it down, reprogramming.
That's a little bit Orwellian. eye movement is a sort of an integrated therapy. EMDR is that incorporates a lot of different aspects, but it's really, just to sum it up really quick, is a way of accessing old memory networks that are painful and traumatizing and then reprocessing them with a new positive belief so that they're no longer disturbing. Okay. That's the simplest. It doesn't do it justice, but that's all I got.
The last minute, Dr. Wall, I'll give it to you.
What have I got?
What do you want to leave us with any important thoughts about this?
I think that in order to have our lives have the most meaning, it is important to free ourselves from the hang-ups and the limitations that are imposed upon us by past experiences that do, if in fact there are issues that limit our enjoyment of our lives.
I like that. Also implies that we're going to need a lot more psychiatrists and psychologists, since we all probably have some hang-ups based on our previous experiences.
Well, I wish I could do it all over again.
Listen, this has really been a pleasure for me. I hope everyone has gotten the most, a lot out of this, and I point them to your website, your link on alaskapublic.org. If you go to line one, you can get a link to the Bridges Counseling Connection. There's a link to the National Institute of Mental Health website on post-traumatic stress, where you'll find lots more on anxiety and also lots more good, reliable information if you're looking for stuff on mental health. There are also 2 websites addressing this eye movement. I'm going to say the wrong word here. What is it? Eye movement?
It's EMDR.
EMDR.
Yeah, it's now you got me having a blank, and I do it all the time. Yeah. Eye movement.
Reprocessing.
Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
There you go.
There we go. All right.
Brain block.
So thanks very much to both of you. If you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join us at our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to be talking about a hypothetical 45-year-old lady named Ms. Johnson who has breast cancer. From diagnosis through treatment, we're going to be talking about the options and recommendations for those with Anchorage breast surgeon Dr. Lori Bleicher and cancer specialist Dr. Jean Anderson. Pat Yak is vice president of public media. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer today. Thanks for listening, especially those who called. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.